Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to Getting Savvy in Health, Wealth, and Beauty. Important to note that everything is for entertainment purposes only. Please do speak and meet with a financial advisor before making any investment decisions. And also, please meet and speak with your GP before making any health or beauty decisions.
Okay. Another tech win there, Melissa. We hit the recording button correctly because we didn't do it once. So anyway, welcome everybody to Getting Savvy. I'm Catherine. We've got Dr. Melissa here and also a special guest, Barry Allen. Again, I wanted to call you Dr. Barry, but you're a doctor of the bond market. You're a veteran Wall Street Bay Street investor. So you are a doctor of sorts.
Well, not welcome. Like a real doctor, your partner, but I'll take it.
You'll take it. Okay. All right. So let's get right into it. And one of the reasons we wanted Barry on for your expertise, your view of the markets, but in particular, Melissa was curious about the bond market, but we have to start and step back because we've got the Dow down 818 points. It's been dropping over the past hour or so because this is the day after the Israelis airstrikes on Iran. And now I think, Barry, you're probably watching your ticker screen, but like, what's the latest? Now we're seeing counterattacks?
Now we're seeing the reciprocal attacks that there's a massive missile barrage from Iran towards Israel. And Israel has the most sophisticated missile defense system in the world, but nothing's 100%. And, you know, it's dangerous. So it's worth watching a lot. The markets are responding to this with weaker stock markets and much higher oil prices. But the history of these things is they don't last very long generally. It's hard to fire a massive barrage of missiles at another country day after day after day to do that, and especially if most of them are being intercepted midair and being destroyed. So we'll see how this play out, but my guess is like it's another skirmish in the Middle East, and I've always had the view that there'll never be peace in the Middle East, unfortunately. It's just, if you go to Jerusalem, you'll understand why, because, you know, one of the three holiest sites in Islam is 800 yards away from the holiest site in Judaism, and about 5 miles away from the holiest site in Christianity. And people are going to be fighting over those things forever, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, stepping back and away from that, Barry, you know, we were, you know, before we hit the recording button, just kind of talking a little bit about the markets. And, you know, you seem to have a bit of a cautious view right now. Maybe just to kind of describe your thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's very simple. I think the market is expensive by historical standards. The multiple is several multiples higher than the long-term average. And that would be fine if earnings were growing above average and the economic outlook was really attractive, or we were expecting material drops in interest rates. And economic growth is below average, and the Fed is showing no evidence that they're going to lower interest rates anytime soon. So you take those two situations and you look at above average equity multiple, that tells me it's expensive, and I think you should be cautious.
Melissa, you jump in if you have any questions, you know.
Okay, so to like the layperson, what that means, now's not a great time to be buying. Now's a great time to just sort of be playing it safe with, is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, I think, you know, the promoters of stocks will tell you that you should buy every dip in the stock market because on average, over the last 80 years, that's worked, which is actually correct. But it's not correct when the market is very expensive. And for example, the last time the market as a multiple was this expensive was early 2000 after the tech bubble. And the S&P 500 took 14 years to get back to the peak it had in March 2000. And so there are definitely times, on average, if the market is cheap, you should buy every dip. But when the market is expensive, buying the dip becomes dramatically riskier. And that's I think people should be more cautious. They should have less equity exposure. They should have lower beta stocks. And even though the bond market hasn't performed and there's a lot of worry about inflation, you probably should own more short duration investment grade credit than you would normally. That's the things that you've that have worked over the last 80 years in situations when the stock market is this expensive.
So a lot to follow up on, but Melissa, you go ahead if you have questions.
Okay, so, you know, it's very easy for the new do-it-yourself investor to buy equities online. You know, you can just go onto your trading platform and you want to buy a stock, you put it in order just like you're online shopping. But it's not easy for the person to buy bonds like that. So when you're saying play it safe and be more, you know, but what, you know, it's hard to know what that means.
Okay. How do you do it?
It is virtually impossible for retail investors to buy bonds individually. But there are the thing about the ETF craze that has developed over the last 15 years is ETFs are actually stocks that trade on the stock market. And you can find a bond ETF that holds like short duration corporate bonds, long duration government bonds. There's an ETF for everything in the world, in the bond world, just like there, you can buy, you know, thousands and thousands of stocks in different industries and so on. So retail investors should really look at the ETFs that hold bonds. And I would say shorter duration, 5 years and under, higher quality, single A, double A corporate bonds that are yielding 6% today have, you know, are a risk reward massively better than the stock market today. And that's not
interesting.
So what can I'm trying to think of a ticker of an example of
do you have one, Barry?
I don't because I don't trade them. I trade individual bonds.
Right.
So I think I own JNK, which is a high yield bond.
A high yield.
Okay.
Companies with more leveraged balance sheets. So they're riskier bonds. And if we go into recession or do then the default rate's going to rise, and that's not what you want to own.
Okay.
But if I had 10 minutes to go away, I could go find five and investment grade bonds, ETFs, and I can send you after the program some that we'll find out. But if you just actually in Canada, Bank of Montreal is the leader in ETFs. And if you went on their website and look at the list of ETFs and you searched for shorter duration investment grade bond ETFs, I'm sure they'll list, you know, probably
hundreds
of them.
And we'll do that and we'll send it out to people. But I want to just, you know, there's some words in there, Barry, that not everybody's going to know. Duration just means time. When do they mature? That's what duration means. So 0 to 5 years. Okay. Then you can have, you know, duration 10 years. That means it matures in 10 years.
Right.
So just to be clear, because there's a lot of wording in there that sounds complicated and I don't want people's eyes to glaze over because it's not that complicated. Number one, but number two, investment grade. Describe what that means.
That means a corporation that has an investment grade debt rating by the rating agencies. And in JNK stands for junk. So that means junk bond, non-investment grade.
Okay.
triple C, single B, double B rated. And investment grade is triple B, single A, double A, triple A. So they're very bigger companies, higher quality, very, very low default risk. Like I would say less than 1% of investment grade bonds would default. On average, high yield bonds or junk bonds, about 4% of them default.
So not many.
Not many. In fact, 4% is made up of triple C bonds where 25% of them default, and single B bonds, which about 4% of them default, and double B bonds, which less than 1% default. So if you concentrated high yield bonds in single B and double B, the risk reward of owning them is extremely high.
Okay. So let me just break that down too. Just think about, the grades that you get in school. If you get an A, you're obviously better than a C student and a D student. So that's essentially how, when he says, when Barry
The
says triple A.
opposite of a brassiere.
Don't know about that.
Sorry. Double D is a lot better than an A, but let's go
Right.
back to Vaughn. Sorry.
Yeah, bonds are the opposite of brassieres then.
There you go.
That's what she said. That's what Melissa said. But it
Okay.
depends. Well, but the reason why I was silent was because I don't know. Is a triple D boob size better than a triple A or an A?
Well, it's
In the
preference.
ball, right?
It's preference, so it is different.
It's
Okay.
preference. But getting back to your bonds, I just couldn't help the
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay, so the triple, but just so A's in the bond world are better than a D, okay? And but they rate them. So it's not just A, B, C, D. It's triple A is better than a double A. So three A's. So a rating agency will say AAA. So that's a triple A rating
Yeah,
or
there's
AA.
very few people in the world. I'm not sure that there's any corporations in the world that have AAA.
Now,
They
if you're
used
that's a
to.
corporation, but if you're looking at government, where would the US fall in terms of a rating
Well,
right
good
now?
question.
the U.S. is has one AAA rating. If there's four rating agencies,
Yeah.
one of them is AAA, and the other three are AA plus. So not only is there AAA, AA, and single A, but there's plus and minus for each one too.
Right.
So there's a lot of slicing and dicing in those categories.
And by the way, where's Canada? What's the rate in Canada? I don't even know.
Just double A.
Double A. Okay.
That's pretty high in the world.
Yeah, it is.
Shouldn't be, but it is.
It shouldn't be.
If Canada's border wasn't right next to the United States, it would be triple B or single A, given their
Right.
profile.
And which
Yeah.
is Trump's saying, right? That's what the whole thing is, that Trump's saying, and even Elon was saying too, like, what's Canada without the US? We're not even a real country. I mean, that's their,
Unfortunately, it's sad, but it's true.
Yeah.
Like the Canadian economy is 80% dependent on the US. And the old saying, if the US catches cold, Canada gets pneumonia. And that's true of countries that are, and Mexico is probably even worse.
Yeah.
Right. I just want to go back for 1 second, Melissa, because you do own JMK, which does stand for junk bonds, which just means a lower rating. But to Barry's point, sometimes there's a lot of opportunity in that area of the market, just depending on prices and mispricing. But I want to just mention too, Barry, if you really think about it, back in the day, it was the Drexel Burnham guys, Mike Milken, who started the whole junk bond market by
Yeah.
encouraging corporations that maybe, shouldn't be issuing debt, but they're going to issue debt and they're just going to have to pay you a really high interest rate to buy that debt. So it used to be called junk bonds, and then they got this nice name called high yielding bonds. It kind of took away the junk name, even though that ticker still says JNK. Am I wrong or right?
No, that's correct. And quite honestly, the credit quality or the default risk of the junk bond market or high yield bond market today is enormously less risky than it was 25 or 30 years ago. And even 10 years ago, the average credit quality of a non-investment grade issuer is way more. There used to be 30% of the high yield debt market were triple C rated, and now it's about 10%. So the overall credit quality, and when you're coming out of recession and credit spreads are wide, excuse me, that's when you want to own junk bonds. But
So you have to, yeah.
right now credit spreads are tight. Are
Describe what that means.
it
Describe
means
what
that
that
they're
means.
well, if the average credit spread for the high yield market over the last 40 years is 400 basis points over a government bond, or they pay 4% higher interest than a government bond. Right now, it's about 3% or 300 basis points. So the return you're getting is much below average. And that's because default rates have been really low for a long time. Because every time there's an economic problem, the central banks have printed trillions of dollars and got us out of it. The question
Right.
is, will that work the next time? And the bond market is really questioning that right now.
Yeah.
A lot of angst
Barry,
about.
that's
Yeah.
yeah, so and that's why, Melissa sent me an article because there are comments and concerns that the bond market, and for people to understand, the bond market tells one story a lot of the time, and the stock market tells another story. Sometimes it's the same narrative, but the market continues to move higher, yet the bond market continue is selling off. And for people to understand, they always say that the bond market investors like Barry are smarter than the equity investors like myself. And I'm talking on the institutional side that, and bond guys tend to be more negative, whereas the equity people tend to be more optimistic. This is just the truth on the institutional side. On Wall Street and Bay Street. So sometimes they say that the negative people see the issues, they see the details a little bit more. They're a bit smarter on that front. So the bond market, and this is why we wanted to get you on, because Melissa saw this article that's saying, like, what is the bond market seeing that nobody else is?
Yeah, okay. So I think that's a really good question because the bond market right now is giving off conflicting indicators and isn't sure what to do. And I believe the bond market is discounting a economic scenario going forward of stagflation. Now, stagflation is about the worst possible situation where rising inflation and weakening economic growth. That's bad for everybody, whether you're a stock investor or a bond investor or anything, it's bad for everybody. But I'm not as negative on the economic environment as the bond market is right now because I'm old and I've been doing this a long time, and I've studied stagflation a lot.
Really?
Yes, and I started studying stagflation a lot in 08 because we had this global financial crisis, and the central banks did something they'd never done before. They lowered rates to zero, and in some countries, a lot of countries, they lowered rates to negative rates. That had never happened before. And on top of that, they printed trillions and trillions of dollars and used those dollars to buy government bonds, to lower interest rates, to support economic growth. And when that happened, the knee-jerk reaction is, wow, this is going to end up in inflation. In the end, inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. And we just created out of thin air an extra $10 trillion of money. And the amount of goods in the that you can buy with those $10 trillion didn't change. In fact, they declined because we're in weak economic times. So that's the perfect recipe for inflation. But did we have inflation after 08? No, we
No.
basically zero inflation and zero interest rates all the way to 2020. And then we had a global pandemic. And then the central banks did the same thing. They printed another $10 trillion. So now, in the last 15 years, the central banks around the world have printed about 20 trillion extra dollars. And those dollars are still there. They never go away. They don't. When the Fed lowers it, sells bonds to decrease its balance sheet, somebody buys those bonds, and every dollar they printed in the last 15 years is still in the economy. It doesn't go away until you have a bad recession and you have destruction of capital, which we haven't had because the central banks haven't allowed that to happen. Whereas in the 70s and 80s, we had really bad recessions and excess leverage got punished and we had big destruction of capital. That hasn't happened in the last, in the last 25 years. So, but after the pandemic, we did have inflation. And we had inflation because the pandemic took a significant number of people out of the labor force, so we had wage inflation. And also we had all this money that had been created, and all of a sudden now they were chasing the same number of goods. And we also had a lot of fluctuations in oil prices. So the inflation took a long time to happen, but it happened now. Question is now how sustainable it is. And my view of it is it's not that sustainable in the short term, in 1 to 3 years, because I think we've had interest rates go from 0 to 5%, and that so far hasn't hurt the economy so much because all this printed money is supporting the economy. But now we're starting to, and not only that, probably the most important thing that happened is the governments around the world were running huge fiscal deficits. The economy's going to do better if, in the US case, if they're running 7% of GDP, that's 30 trillion, that's $2.5 trillion that the government is injecting into the economy that wouldn't be happen if they were running a balanced budget. $2.5 trillion keeps a lot of things going that wouldn't otherwise be going if they didn't do that.
So in other words, the deficits kind of keep the lights on.
That's right.
And so I kind of believe, to your point about we haven't had the destruction of capital. We haven't had deep recessions in 25 years, since I think 1994-ish. Don't know if I'm doing my math right.
2000. The
2000. Yeah, 2000.
was
Okay.
pretty bad.
Okay. So I can't see any leader in the world today that's going to want to lead a recession
Right. Well,
just
isn't that the
be
criticism of Trump? Like, isn't that what he planned to do? And then it sort of seemed like then reverse course with the big, beautiful bill.
I think he's still planning to reduce the US deficit materially. But he knows that, well, let's take Canada for an example. Canada was in a sovereign debt crisis in the late 80s and early 90s. And Canada was incapable of issuing government debt to foreigners in Canadian dollars because the Canadian dollar had gone from part to like 68 cents.
Wait, I want to stop you for 1 second. When you said incapable of issuing, do you mean foreigners did not want to buy Canadian government debt?
Unless it was in U.S. dollars.
Oh.
Okay, because they didn't want the Canadian dollar risk.
Oh.
The Canadian dollar depreciate by 35%. So, like, Canadian bonds yielded 14%, and U.S. bonds yielded 8%, which two economies that are indelibly linked. 600 basis points difference in bond yields is enormous. And the reason for that is because nobody wanted Canadian dollar risk. And so Canada had to pay 14% for their bonds, where US were at 8%. But the only buyers of Canadian bonds were Canadians. Foreigners, like in Asia, Japan, were huge buyers of Canadian bonds. After that, they would only buy them in US dollars. So that's what, and every country goes through this. When they get too heavily indebted, their currency depreciates. And when their currency depreciates, the inflation rate in their economy goes up because everything they import goes up in price and causes inflation to rise. And when inflation rises, interest rates rise. And when interest rates rise, your economy goes down.
Isn't that what happened in Greece a few years ago?
Hmm?
Isn't that what happened in Greece?
Oh, yeah. Well, Greece was lying about their debt levels. And then when they joined the euro, they audited their debt. And all of a sudden they said, oops, yeah, our debt's really 50% higher than we hoped for. And then they had a sovereign debt crisis, right? And
right.
Buy Greek government bonds.
Yeah. And isn't that the fear that that's what could be happening to the U.S.?
Well,
the bonds are selling off and the yields are going up. And
here is that the U.S. dollar is going to weaken. Nobody's really worried about a sovereign debt crisis in the U.S. because it's the biggest, most liquid bond market in the world. And, you know, if the U.S. is in trouble, every other country in the world's in worse trouble. Okay, so it's a relative thing. But what the bond market is worried about is stagflation, which I'm not really that worried about because I've studied it a lot after 08. And stagflation has only occurred in Western countries in really, really high inflation environments. It's the only time in North America we've had stagflation was in the 1970s and 80s. And so we had 10 to 12% inflation and 0% economic growth. And it makes sense because if you have inflation at 12% and interest rates at 15%, it's pretty
hard to have
any economic growth at all.
Right.
Who can afford, what company can afford to pay 18% interest rates and grow your business?
Yeah.
It just doesn't work, right?
Go ahead.
So right now, you know, we have 2.5% inflation and 4 to 5% interest rates. We don't have 12% inflation and 15% interest rates. So I think the likelihood of stagflation is very low. But that's the first derivative of the problem, is stagflation. I don't think stagflation is going to happen. But if we go through a period of prolonged U.S. dollar weakness, which isn't impossible, and it's actually fairly likely, because we've just had 30 years of U.S. dollar strength.
Yeah.
And the government's running a higher deficit per GD percentage of GDP than any other country in the world. And so what really the market is worried about is not really stagflation. They're worried about a wholesale devaluation of the US dollar, which means if the US dollar is going down, foreigners aren't going to want to buy US Treasury bonds because they're going to take currency losses. 60% of US Treasuries are held outside of the United States. So you hear about there's huge holdings of US Treasuries in Hong Kong and Japan and Taiwan. Most of the US Treasuries held abroad are in Asia. And if the US dollar starts depreciating against the Asian currencies, then if you own a US Treasury bond and it pays you 4% interest, but the US dollar depreciates 4%, you've got 0% return, right? So you're not going to want, you're better off owning a Japanese bond at 2% and the currency going up 2%, you're going to get a 4% return versus zero in if you hold a US Treasury bond. And if the US keeps running 6 or 7% deficits and foreigners don't want to buy US Treasury bonds, then you can have a situation where US interest rates go up 300 or 400 basis points, even if inflation hasn't
Doesn't.
risen that much. And then the Fed either has to decide to print money and buy the US Treasury bonds, which they're telling everybody they would never do that, despite the fact that they did it, for $10 trillion over the last 15 years. But they're saying, that we would never do that. That would destroy our mandates of creating inflation. So the US has got a pass over the last 15 years, and the massive money printing that's gone on in the US and the rest of the world hasn't really created a lot of inflation. It's created a little bit of inflation, but not a lot. But now we're at the point where if the US doesn't control its deficit, the US dollar is going to weaken materially. The US dollar weakens materially, then you're going to have much higher inflation in the US. Much higher inflation means much higher interest rates, means the biggest economy in the world will become the weakest economy in the world. And the rest of the world, those are the situations where you have global economic downturns. And we're at risk of that if the US doesn't cut its deficit materially.
Very well explained. Thank you for all of that. But the one area that I question is, when you talk about the US dollar weakness cause it as almost the catalyst for what you have described, I would say that, and I thought that the weakness that we saw in the bond market, in other words, foreigners not interested in buying these auctions, these bond issuances, was a little bit more reflective, not of the deficit, because the deficit has been what it's been for quite some time. It's because of the tariffs and the trade tensions and the question about US exceptionalism.
Okay,
That
that.
was the, or is that just a media narrative? You're laughing.
Okay, so I put those in the category of the straw that breaks the camel's back. Okay, everybody asks me, what's the catalyst for a US sovereign debt crisis? The answer is nobody knows, and there are always some of not, something that's not really that meaningful in the long. thing. It's just all of a sudden it happens and people pay attention to it. The tariffs in the end, I don't worry about the tariffs at all. The US has said that all they want to do is create reciprocal tariffs.
Right.
So they're going to have tariffs, whatever, US will have tariffs, whatever equal to whatever the other countries have. Okay? So if tariffs are reciprocal to every country in the world, what exactly the point is having any tariff? It doesn't matter.
Because it's a net zero, it neutralizes
It's net zero.
itself.
Well, but except for the fact that if the US has had less tariffs than other places and now they raise them, it's a way to raise money for the
It
government.
is, but it's a short-term thing. It raises money and decreases economic activity and increases inflation and interest rates. So it doesn't help. It doesn't raise money in the long term. It's politically nice and that, but the goal is not to have huge tariffs for the US. The goal is, they say, is to have. We only want to have tariffs that are at the same level as other countries have.
But let me ask you a question. If every country raises tariffs,
Yeah.
isn't it just a way for every government to tax their citizens more without calling it a tax?
Won't make any money in that environment because if Europe sends us a good and we put a 10% tariff on that, the government collects 10% and the price of it goes up 10%. And what we send to Europe, they do the exact same thing. Nobody has gained anything.
No, just the consumer has lost. I mean, the average
Consumer has
person.
lost, and if the consumer loses, they stop buying.
And then inflation and the. Yeah.
Comes up, and economic, we go into a recession, and everybody has lost.
Yeah,
So there's
so, right.
no winning with tariffs, okay? But what Trump is doing actually makes sense because. Especially China. Look at China is a country that if a US company wants to go start a subsidiary in China, they have to give 50% of the company's equity to a
Yeah.
Chinese company for zero.
Not
Chinese
fair.
companies can come and start any company they want in the United States. And if they put in all the capital, they get all the equity. That's inherently unfair. And then if you have tariffs on what the US sends to China, if they charge tariffs, and these ownership rules are just tariffs by another name. So
Right.
if the Trump's tariffs are designed to have free trade and in the end, they want to end up with no tariffs. And
Negotiating tool to get them to, yeah.
that's what's best for the world is free trade. And the US wants, US, Trump wants US companies to be able to export to any other company, other country, or set up subsidiaries in any other country and compete in those markets, especially China and India, because those are the markets that have the biggest population. And why should Chinese and Indian companies be able to come and compete in the US market unrestricted if the US companies can't do that in India and China?
Right.
So it's inherently unfair. But I'm not worried about tariffs because tariffs aren't going to last long enough to have a material impact on inflation.
What do you think, though, the impact is on the Canadian economy?
Canada is an unfair trader to the US too. I mean, Canada was set up 100 years ago as a branch plant economy where US subsidiaries set up manufacturing plants in Canada to get around the US, the Canadian tariffs. What they were doing is just like China, exactly the same thing. Now, and if you look at the interprovincial trade barriers in Canada, the biggest tariffs in Canada are between the provinces, Canada and the US. Like you can't sell milk or liquor or anything to another province without them putting a tariff or a tax on it.
And I think the problem too, Barry, is that I don't think Canadians know this. I mean,
No,
I
they
didn't know
don't.
that.
They do. Nobody understands the interprovincial trade barriers and the transfer system thing. The bottom line is eight provinces are basically awash, and Alberta sends $30 billion a year to Quebec. That's thing. Why should Albertans do that?
Right. And by the way, with the G7 coming up, they're all arriving this Sunday. I mean, do we really, do we think that Alberta stays within Canada? I mean, now we're shifting focus here a little bit, but it does affect the economy. And by the way, if we don't have their $30 billion funding Ontario, funding Quebec, funding other provinces, what happens to what does that look like?
Well, Alberta's not funding any other province. They're funding Quebec. Okay? That's the reality of it. So the irony of it is Quebec's been talking about separating
Separating,
50
yeah.
years. Alberta's the one that should be talking about separating because they're the one getting screwed, not Quebec. Quebec is a huge beneficiary of Confederation.
Right.
And you know, for the first time this year, I heard that Alberta was talking about having referendums on separation. And economically, there's very strong reasons to do that. I don't think they'll do it. But economically, the numbers say they should.
Yeah.
Why on earth should Alberta send $30 billion a year to Quebec? What's the rationale for that? What's Alberta get out of it?
Well, nothing. They can't even build pipelines. They can't even extract their own natural resources.
Blocked every pipeline.
Yeah.
Like Quebec doesn't buy oil from Alberta. Quebec imports oil from the Middle East, and they won't buy it from Alberta because they won't allow a pipeline from Alberta. Does that make any sense?
No. No, I was always joking with Catherine before that they should brand Alberta as like Dubai of the North. When it's
Sure.
too hot to go to Dubai, we should make Alberta like the Dubai over here and come here and make it like a big, fancy, upscale.
Albertans should use their money to have more fun. I agree.
Yeah, make
That's
it
what
a
I,
big
yeah.
Dubai of the North, ski
Yeah.
Vegas.
Yeah. So anyway, back to
Okay.
the stagflation and that. I'm not really worried about that. But what I am worried about is that the US doesn't get their deficits under control. We have a material devaluation of the US dollar, which then increases inflation in the US and it hires interest rates. And then we have a more than modest economic downturn in the US, which affects the whole world.
So, how would you advise somebody? How
Yeah.
would you advise a young woman or man, coming into their 30s, starting to make some money, wanting to put away money for the future and invest it? What, it What do
feels
you
like,
do?
what do you do?
Well,
the national dream in almost every country is buy a home and have real estate is a good hedge against inflation. So that's one. But housing prices have inflated so much that it's almost doesn't even I like I don't know how much houses can go up in Canada relative to income levels. Like Canada's housing prices relative to average income is virtually the worst in the world. So, but if
But in
that,
the market, Barry, like,
well,
if you're,
then it's gold and Bitcoin. Those are your only hope.
come on.
And shorts.
And sure, there you go. That's what I'm saying. I think Catherine, we have to start talking a little bit about options trading because it feels like, well, no, you're saying shorts, but I'm just saying, like, I don't know. It's like for the past 10 years, everybody's like, oh, just buy index funds, invest in the S&P 500, 100%, you know, and then now, I don't know. It's very confusing to know what to do.
Very now because, buy, hold, and prosper made perfect sense 40 years ago and worked for 40 years. But I think that there's quite a low probability that that's going to work over the next 15, 20 years.
Well, okay, but I also think too, and Melissa and I talk a lot about this, that there's different ways to build your portfolio, right? There's owning mutual funds, which we talked about last time, and I only do that when there's a very specific manager like yourself, Barry, that
That's
we
or a specific theme, right?
there's a specific theme. So there's that. Then
Right
there
there.
is but yeah, then there's buying the ETFs like that represent the broader market. But
Yeah.
what we also talked about, Melissa, last time, and Barry, this is, where I've been focused anyway, is, buying some company specific stories when they get hit. And I know the company is going to be around. And by the way, I might also get a dividend.
Yeah.
So
I mean, if
that works too, you have to admit.
companies that make mistakes, then you can buy them. But the point is of buying the broader market makes no sense to me right now because it's so expensive relative to the economic outlook that,
Agreed.
and don't forget, as I said, the market peaked in March 2000, and it took 14 years for the S&P to actually recapture that peak. So we can go 15 years with the stock market being negative. It's at peaks when it's really expensive. And the
Yeah.
stock market is as expensive now as it was in March 2000. I think it's
But as
very
expensive as it was then, it hasn't it still gone up? So even if you bought it at a high, if it continues to go up, how is that?
But now we're at that, do you really want to buy it on March 2000 and wait 14 years to make money?
Right.
Obviously not. You want to buy
Probably
it at in
not.
2008.
So how do people make money between 2000 and
Well,
2014?
look, there's always new companies and companies that do great.
That's my point.
I think the like gold and uranium is another one.
I invested in uranium recently.
Right.
Recently? I
Yeah.
would
Because I was.
instead of buying a data center, which every wealthy family in the world is doing right now, I'd rather buy things that are going to power that data center because the things that power them are a declining resource where they can build
Uranium, you're talking about uranium and energy.
anything in energy is a non-renewable kind of thing, right? Like natural gas. Natural gas has been way too cheap for 50 years. But they can build as many data centers as they want. There's no restriction on how many data centers the world can build. But there's a restriction on the amount of electricity there is that can power those.
Yeah.
So the lower risk way is to look at what are they doing? And the number one source of energy to power data centers is nuclear. And the number one fuel for nuclear is uranium. So I like the first thing that I'll buy in a stock market downturn is Cameco.
I just bought, yeah. I felt that same way.
Like GDX, the ETF for gold mining shares, it's the biggest thing I own.
Come on.
It is.
Why?
Because the likelihood of gold going down versus going up, even at $3,500, there's way more upside than downside.
Well, hold on a second. Just so everybody is aware who hasn't been watching the price of gold, it has skyrocketed. To your point, it's $3,500. You know, that is something though that also did nothing for many, many years, but
Yeah,
it has done something
20 years.
now. 20 years. And so you actually think that gold can move higher from these current levels?
Way higher because look, the US dollar hasn't even has barely depreciated. And one of the strongest negative correlations in the world is a weaker US dollar and higher gold prices.
Yeah.
Right. So it's inversely correlated. That's what we need to be aware of. So if the US dollar goes down, gold
If
goes
the US
up.
dollar goes down, and it's gone down a little bit, but if it goes down 20%, gold will probably go up 40%.
One quick question, follow up on the US dollar going down. Does that mean, will that, even though there's not a country specific reason, in terms of a positive country specific reason for Canada, for the Canadian dollar to go higher, but so can, will it go higher just because the US dollar goes down, or will there be other factors that will not allow that to happen?
Yes, and then no. So you've seen the Canadian dollar has gone from 145 to 136 as the US dollar has depreciated. But if the US dollar depreciates significantly more and it causes higher interest rates in a weaker US economy, then you're going to see the Canadian dollar go to 160,
Oof.
which is like 60 cents. So right now, Canada, like every country in the world, their currencies are going up because the US dollar is going down. But then you reach an inflection point that people are going, wait a minute, this US dollar depreciation is going to lead to higher interest rates and much weaker US growth. And what happens to Canada's economy when US growth goes down?
Got it.
Pneumonia. And US, the Canadian economy's growth goes down more.
Okay.
So then the Canadian dollar is going to weaken. So you have,
Okay.
we're in this phase where other currencies are going to go up, are going up.
Yeah.
Currencies, it's a zero-sum game, right? If US dollar goes down, something else has to go up. And
Right.
the things that I think are going to go up the most are gold and Bitcoin.
Okay. All right. All right, Barry,
Because
we'll leave.
currencies are just as bad as the US, right?
Yeah.
You want to own the yen or the Chinese currency or the euro or the Canadian dollar? No, you don't.
No.
No. Okay, Barry, stay with us if you can for a second. We're just gonna,
I
we just
want to
have
own
a,
them all.
you want to own them all.
Yeah, and trade them for shoes.
Short the ball.
Just kidding.
What did you say, Barry?
You want to short them all.
Oh, yeah.
If the
Okay.
US is
Yeah.
down, you want to be short everything.
Yeah, right.
Bonds, stocks, everything but gold and Bitcoin.
We'll have somebody on to talk about kind of shorting the market, Melissa, and what that means. It sounds scary, but it's not. It's just a, it's a way to express your view that you believe we're at a peak and things are going to trade lower, and that, and you just take, you get to profit off of that. But Barry, wait, stay with us for a second. We're going to wrap pretty soon. But Melissa, let's just see if there's any, if there's any health topics, Barry, that you might be interested in. Sometimes it's female oriented, sometimes not.
That's okay.
So I had a couple, but you know what? In the interest of time, because I have to jump in about 5 minutes, one interesting study that caught my attention, and it kind of links in with the depressing theme of today's conversation, as well as what's going on in the Middle East with Iran, is saffron. So, as a family doctor, we prescribe a lot of antidepressant medication, specifically SSRIs, which are incredibly helpful drugs. So, if people are having anxiety or depression, we can turn to things like Prozac or Cipralex or Zoloft or any of these SSRI type medications, and they're very effective and they work. The problem is there's a lot of sexual side effects. So, that's something that causes people to stop taking them or prevents people from using them. So, specifically in men and women, it can be decreased desire. You can also have erectile dysfunction and sexual desire disorder. So, it's a problem, and we haven't had a lot in our toolkit in terms of how to manage it. You know, for men, we can prescribe, you know, Viagra, Cialis, which helps. For women, we can try to sometimes add on other medication like bupropion or Wellbutrin. But we don't have a really a lot of good options. So I saw this study, and they actually did a literature review out of Iran, because Iran produces a lot of saffron spice. And
Right.
they looked at people that use saffron, and in five separate studies, it significantly improved sexual desire and sexual function in
Really?
women and men, yes, that were on
That's
anti
good.
medication. So it seems like a low risk, high return kind of experiment.
Very expensive, though, right?
So
Saffron's really expensive, right?
is it?
Yeah. I mean,
Oh, I don't know. So maybe this was just
one
like,
package like this, and it's like $40.
well, I saw this study, so I actually ordered some saffron capsules
Okay.
from iHerb, and they were 50 milligram capsules. So I don't know how much I paid for them, but it didn't seem that different than any other vitamin or supplement you might buy that doesn't
Maybe
work. That's...
that, but I cook with saffron, and it's really
And
expensive
it's
to.
expensive. Okay, so well, and you do you cook with saffron often?
Not enough, obviously.
Yeah, I was gonna say, so let us know how that goes for you. Yeah, and I'm gonna try it and we'll see. And always things like this, if it works even a little bit, it can help. So anyhow, so we'll let you know. But I thought that was an interesting study that I came up.
Tell you that I spent the last 5 years looking hard as I can to find startup medical technology companies. Because obviously, with aging of populations, the demand for technology to intermediate the healthcare space is growing. And it's very hard to find them because the regulatory system is really, really difficult to start any company related to healthcare. Massively regulates it. But I have this thesis that my children are going to live to 120, and that has a material impact on society. And you can grow in a lab today every organ in your body that could be transplanted, including your brain. It's just not legal to do so. And I think the whole stem cell research thing will become more and more acceptable over time, and it's going to change the average age of lifespan of people materially, and there's going to be a whole bunch of impacts on that. So, Melissa, if you know any companies that are doing things that in those spaces, and they're raising money, let me know.
Oh, well, I agree with you. It's a huge growth industry right now. And I agree with you on your prediction about lifespan and healthspan as well. People are living longer and they're living healthfully longer.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's going to be huge innovations coming.
I totally. And I wanna live the life that I have when I was 60 years old for 20 more years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
So
we need to, we need, I do want to have like a stem cell expert on, Melissa. Like, I want I know somebody that we can have on and
to. Okay.
talk about. He's working back and forth between here and Dubai, actually. And I know that they've decreased a lot of the regulations in Florida recently on stem cell use.
But Dubai it's wide open there, and there's a lot of companies going there.
Let's go, Melissa.
Girls trip and bearing.
Hey, Dubai's a good road trip, believe me. I've had a few of them there.
You know what? We're going.
Good.
Girls trip and Barry.
All right, I'm in.
Okay. All
All
right. We'll
right.
leave it there,
Thank you so
everybody.
much for the conversation. It was
All
great.
right, take care,
Yeah.
you
Thanks, Barry.
guys.
Bye. Talk to you later. Bye.